702. The Naked Scientist.
It's 23 minutes to 3 o'clock, and he tweeted just moments ago saying, "Here we go on Radio 702 and Azania, answering your science questions. What would you like to know?" So 011-883-0702 and 31702 for your SMSs. But we always prefer for you to call so that you can chat directly to Chris Smith, the Chair of Science at the University of Cambridge, and of course, our Naked Scientist. And yes, he belongs to... He's not just ours, but for the purposes of this conversation in this half hour, he's our Naked Scientist. Hello, Chris.
I'm always yours, Zania. I'm always yours. Yeah.
Thank you.
Here we are.
I was feeling like it's a little too... Maybe I'm stretching it. Oh, maybe others will be aggrieved. So let me try and correct that. But thank you for affirming that. So what's big in the science world this week?
Well, as we go into winter, we're all worried about flu, and this is in the Northern Hemisphere, of course, but that means the Southern Hemisphere is watching what happens to us this winter, because that's how you're going to get all your vaccines in the next season, because the way that flu works is it goes around the world in a giant sort of pandemic every year. And what the Northern Hemisphere have becomes the Southern Hemisphere's next outbreak. So everyone watches what happens to the opposite hemisphere, collects samples of those flu viruses, and then compares them to what we're currently using as vaccines. And if the flu looks like it's evolving so the vaccine won't work, they try and guess what it's going to turn into and then make the next vaccine from that. So that's what they've done this year. So everyone's now getting vaccinated based on what was circulating in South Africa and Australia and so on in the previous 6 months. And hopefully the choice will be correct, because they put three or four different strains of flu into the vaccine. And the flu has already arrived in Britain. We're already getting cases here.
Yeah.
So now we're going to start the trial of seeing if these vaccines work this year.
And why is it always changing? Why is it on the move? Is it that every virus is able to withstand whatever antimicrobials we throw at it for that season?
Well, some viruses are really stable. In other words, they hardly change at all.
Uh-huh.
And a good example of a virus like that would be measles, for example. We don't know exactly why, but measles very rarely changes its genetic makeup. But other viruses, and the flu is one of them, are a moving target. They make lots of genetic spelling mistakes when they copy their genetic information. And this is because the machinery they have in the virus that copies their equivalent of DNA actually makes genetic spelling mistakes when it makes those copies. It's rather like me giving you a book and saying, can you copy this out?
Right.
And as you make the copy, you introduce the wrong letters here and there in the words that you spell. And this sounds like a bad thing, but actually it's enormously advantageous to the virus, because what it does is it changes subtly the way the virus looks and the way it works. And this means it's continuously evolving. And if it changes its appearance, our immune system has evolved to be really good at recognizing things that you've seen before and killing them before they get started.
Yeah.
So if something changes its appearance, the immune system is wrong-footed and it has to play catch-up. So by continuously evolving and changing in this way, viruses like the flu mean that they can continue to sidestep your immune system and keep infecting you throughout life. Whereas other viruses like measles have one go at getting you. They infect you, they make you really ill, and you then either spread the virus to other people or you die and spread the virus to other people. Either way, you're going to never get measles again, because you're either dead or lifelong immune. So the virus makes up for that by being really, really, really infectious and infecting lots of people.
Yes.
Flu, on the other hand, is less infectious than measles, but it mutates so it can keep coming back and keep catching you many times through life, because it never looks the same again.
Wow, absolutely fascinating. And even then, you know, it's not a bacteria, so antimicrobials are not necessarily the way we should approach it, even though some doctors still do, you know, whether it's a flu or a cold, you end up getting a bacteria being, or rather a virus being treated with antibiotics, which the world, of course, is on high alert for.
Yep, we're very worried about that, actually. It's now become one of our highest priorities, because the rate at which microorganisms are becoming resistant to antibiotics has never been so high. And as a result, we're now beginning to see some sorts of infections that actually we can't treat anymore. And for that reason, many countries are introducing policies of good antimicrobial stewardship. The idea being that we try to be much more discerning about when we use antibiotics and when we don't use antibiotics, because in this day and age, we do have much better diagnostic techniques that are much faster and mean that we can very quickly make decisions about whether a person really needs antibiotics or not. And the bottom line is, viruses are not treated with antibiotics. Viruses don't respond to antibiotics. The only exception to this is if you have a viral infection and you then catch a bacterial infection off the back of it, because sometimes if you catch, say, a bad dose of flu, the virus can go in and damage your airways. It could damage your lung tissue, for example, and it's a bit like throwing cannonballs at a castle wall. It knocks holes in your defences, and then bacteria that you previously would have been able to bat off then can gain a toehold. And so sometimes you do get a bacterial infection on top of a viral infection. And in those instances, yes, you often do need antibiotics. But the numbers of cases where this applies is actually very few in the grand scheme of things. 90% of the time, those symptoms you're having are going to be a virus, and an antibiotic is just going to give you diarrhea and side effects and is probably not a good idea.
Absolutely.
Because it's just going to cost you money and make you feel worse.
Right. So let's go to the lines, 011-883-0702, to chat to the Naked Scientist. That's Chris Smith. Max, good afternoon. You're calling us from the Joburg CBD. Hi.
Hi, Vanya. Hi, Chris. I just wanted to know, is it possible to sweat while swimming?
Okay. What kind of water are we swimming on? Is it cold or warm or what?
Well, either.
So whichever. All right. So, Chris, any thoughts? Is it possible?
Is it? I didn't catch the one key word, the verb. Is it possible to...
To sweat while you're swimming.
Right, hello Max. Right, why do we sweat? We sweat in order to control our body temperature. Humans are warm-blooded. We're so-called homeotherms. Homeo meaning same. We maintain a rigid control of our body temperature to the greatest extent possible because we have a metabolism that is heat-producing, and we sometimes produce more heat than we need, and we have to get rid of that heat. The way we do that is by diverting blood close to the skin surface and down our peripheries, fingers and toes, and that blood is hot and radiates heat out of the body. At the same time, though, if that's not losing enough heat, you secrete sweat, which is a thin layer of water made from blood plasma, onto the skin surface. The water evaporates, robbing the skin of latent heat of evaporation, and that takes an extra burst of energy away from your skin, cooling you further. Now, if you're in water, if you're in cold water, that water is doing a much better job than your sweat will, because you're already covering your body in a layer of cold water, which is going to wick away the heat from your body very, very effectively. So the likelihood is if you're in cold water, you're actually going to be thermally challenged, and you're going to reduce the blood flow to the skin, and you're going to reduce the blood flow to your sweat gland. So you're not going to sweat underwater. If, on the other hand, you are in really hot water, this is going to lead to your body beginning to overheat, and all the mechanisms that lead to heat loss are going to kick in and go into overdrive. You're going to push loads of blood close to your skin surface. You're going to push the sweat glands working to the maximum. So you could actually dehydrate very effectively, very fast, in very hot conditions, that are despite being surrounded by water, because your body will desperately try to lose heat. So the answer is, it will, as you pointed out, Azania, it will depend on the temperature of the water.
Right. Max, there you go.
Thank you.
Thank you. Because I guess by swimming, it's like a workout. You know, your heart rate is up. And if you had to exert, perhaps in a similar way, outside of water, we see sweat. But as you said, that this is would be very different underwater. So let's take a break. And then when we come back, more of your calls for Chris Smith, the Naked Scientist, on 011-883-0702. Maybe there's a scientific concept that you've been curious about, that you want him to explain and clarify. I mean, look at that, the antimicrobial conversation, virus versus bacteria, and around the flu, where it went once Chris got started. So 011-883-0702. We've got Martin now calling from Johannesburg as well. Hi, Martin.
Hi, Azra. How are you?
Very good.
Good. Chris, this is a peculiar one. Well, not a peculiar one. We've got a newborn in the home that never smiles when she's awake, right?
Yeah.
But will smile continuously when she's asleep. smile and laugh continuously when she's asleep. And so I ask myself, when adults or slightly grown up people sleep and smile and laugh in their things, those are from memories that they would have or incidences that would have happened during the day that affect or that cause them to smile and happen. What goes through a baby's mind? I don't know how else to think it.
Yes. No, we get what you're saying. What have the elders said, Martin? What is the, like, different people in your community said is going on?
Sorry?
What have the elders or other people in your community said is going on? Because there's some...
No.
Nothing. No one has said anything.
I haven't asked. No, I haven't asked. It's been something that I see all the time. I'm like, well, what memories does she have?
Yes. And how many...
smile and laugh.
How old is she, Martin?
7 weeks.
7 weeks. Yesterday. How adorable. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Chris, any theories around this?
Hello, Martin. Now, the one thing about smiling and laughing is that it's a spontaneous human trait, and babies do this, but they don't really start doing it meaningfully until they're about 3 months old or so. So I think she's still a bit diddy. You don't really get your first smiles until a couple of months in a baby. So at this stage, those smiling-type facial movements are chiefly, often, just wind. It sounds awful, doesn't it? But actually, the time that babies tend to smirk and pull sort of grimaces and funny facial contortions is because they've got bellyache, or they've got trapped wind, or they're about to do a poo. So I wouldn't interpret too much from the smiles at this stage. But once they get a bit older, the reactive smiling definitely kicks in. Babies maintain eye contact. They begin to smile and laugh. And if you think about it, this is really important from a bonding point of view, because that baby is absolutely dependent on its parents for its survival. It's going to be like that for, in the case of the modern era, about 35 years. But in the olden days, it would have been for several years, wouldn't it, until the baby actually is up and about. And therefore, bonding with your parents, getting them to love you and trust you and want you to be one with them is very critical. And so human babies have evolved to prioritise the development of those reflexes, but it does still take a little while. When they go to sleep, who knows what babies think about when they sleep? Their brain is immature, it's just developing, but it's almost certain that they do experience dreams, and they can certainly have interests in things. But when they're asleep, they're going to dream the same way we do, but they're not going to remember those dreams. But probably those dreams will be translated into reflex responses in the same way that ours are. And so there will be potentially some vocalizations, some movements, etc., in the same way we do that. So I suspect that there's a mixture of bellyache, wind, and a developing brain that's beginning to want to lay down the pathways that will make smiling happen. But I wouldn't worry. I don't think that's going to happen quite yet. You're literally on the cusp of when it should start happening with her now.
Oh, how lovely. Well, I've heard certain elderly people saying that, no, she's remembering where she was before she came to this world. That's why I asked about what he may have heard this could be due to. But there's the scientific explanation, Martin. Let's take a break and more of your calls after this with Chris Smith.
702, The Naked Scientist.
It's 8 minutes to 3 o'clock. Let's go to Jenny in Joburg. Hi, Jenny.
Hello, how are you today?
We're very good. Thank you for the call.
Good, good. Yeah, it's a beautiful, sunny day, isn't it?
Yeah, weather's been fantastic. What have you got on the mind?
I would just like to ask Chris. A couple of years back, I spoke to him about is vaping worse than smoking or vice versa? Mm-hmm. And he did give me an answer about he didn't advocate either of them. But in the final analysis, he said that the vaping was slightly less invasive. Now, there's been a whole hoo-ha somewhere in the States where they were removing all the vapes from the shelves. And then all the people that smoke to you, you're much worse off vaping. So I just wanted to ask him, because I enjoy my vape and I would never like to go back to smoking. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So your thoughts, Chris, on some of the recent revelations and really the dangers of vaping?
Yeah, hello, Jen. Nice to talk to you. As is being highlighted here, my stance on this has always been that neither is good, and you shouldn't do either if you can avoid it, because at the end of the day, you're putting foreign substances into your lungs that are irritant. If there's nicotine there, that's addictive, and in both cases, that's going to be harmful to you compared with just breathing fresh air. But if you were to say to me, should I smoke a cigarette or should I use a vape, then the evidence seems to suggest that vaping is still much better for your health than smoking a cigarette, because there's far more in a cigarette that's bad for you than there is in a vape. The problem that's emerged recently is, I mean, we've been alluding to this all along, we're probably seeing now the confirmation, now we've got some data on what actually happens, because when vaping was first introduced, we had no information to fall back on mm-hmm. what the health impacts could be, whereas we had hundreds of years of data on cigarette smoking and 50 years of really, really rigorous statistical data on the health effects of cigarette smoking. And we know that cigarette smoking is probably the worst hands-down thing you can do for your health. It causes lung cancer and chest disorders, but what many people don't realise is actually very, very bad for your heart. And in fact, most people don't get chest problems like lung cancer because they don't live long enough, because they die of a heart attack or a stroke before those things happen. Mm-hmm. A vape does not carry the same risk of those things, but it does have the ability to irritate your chest in other ways, because there are various chemicals in these vapes and they have the ability to damage the airway cells, they have the ability to change the stickiness of those cells, mm-hmm. and they therefore have the ability to encourage infection. And we're now also seeing other sort of immune reactions and other kind of irritations and inflammatory changes occurring because of chemicals in these vapes. And the other major concern with them is that because they are regarded as in some way a bit healthier, or by some people very healthy, then what they're doing is using this as a gateway. They're encouraging people to get into this because they're saying, oh, well, don't smoke, that's bad, but you could do this. This is an okay alternative. And so young people who would never have smoked are actually potentially embracing vaping. And there's quite good evidence now on large numbers of students who are never going to become smokers. They said they hated the idea of smoking, etc., who've actually become vapers. So there is the risk that this could be a gateway into taking substances, which could then open other doors beyond that. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. so that's another health concern, that we're not just looking at the people who are doing something good for their health by switching from cigarettes to vapes, but there is the risk that people who would never have gone on to smoke are now becoming vapers, and they are therefore adding damage to their health.
Yeah.
So the best advice is you shouldn't do this if you can avoid it. But if you are torn, do I smoke or do I vape? I would say the evidence still is that vaping's probably better for you than cigarette smoking.
Hmm. Less dangerous. Let's go to Bianca in Lone Hill next. Hello, Bianca.
Hi, Azza. How are you doing?
Good. Welcome, Bianca. Your question?
Good. Excellent. So I've recently been diagnosed with a thing called sensory CIDP, mm-hmm. which is chronic inflammatory demyelinating polyneuropathy. So in essence, my immune system is eating the sheathing of my nerve, my periphery nerve.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to know if there's any, like what do you do about it? I have been to my doctor and they recommend steroids and things like Polygam and Oxygam, but what do we know about it? Because there seems to be very, very rare thing.
Okay.
Hello, Bianca. This is a confusing topic. And yes, CIDP, chronic inflammatory demyelinating polyneuropathy, which is why we call it CIDP, it is known and it is actually relatively common. I've looked after patients in the past who have had this. In fact, I used to help them out with their infusions of immunoglobulins. We know it's something to do with the immune system. We know it's something to do with the immune system attacking something it shouldn't, which in cases of this condition is, as you allude to, the sheath, the myelin, which surrounds a nerve cell. And nerves, when they connect from A to B, they are surrounded by myelin, which helps the nerve signals to get through. And the immune system, for some reason, regards that peripheral myelin as hostile and starts attacking it. And at the moment, the way this is managed is by damping down the immune response. And one way to do that is to give infusions of immunoglobulins collected from the general humans. And this seems to prevent or slow down the rate at which this happens. But we don't know why it happens in the first place. But we do know that untreated, it does lead to quite significant symptoms. And people say if they begin to miss these doses mm-hmm. of the immunoglobulins, they get quite bad symptoms back again. So I'm really sorry, I can't give you the answer as to what causes this, because we don't know.
Right. I'd actually never heard of it. So thank you, Bianca, for putting something new on our radar so that we can learn more, know more. Chris, thank you so much. We're out of time.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me, everybody. See you soon.
Thank you. So next week, 2:30, that's our time with the Naked Scientist, Chris Smith. And of course, thank you for all your questions.